Hi everyone, and welcome to my show called We Were Lied To About 9/11. I am your host, John Gold, and this show is part of the Soapbox People's Network. This week, we're going to focus specifically on the 28 redacted pages of the Joint Congressional Inquiry into 9/11.
Hi, this is John, and I'm here with Brian McGlinchey. Brian, how are you doing today?
Oh, great. Thanks so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Oh, not a problem. Thank you for being on. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to read your bio. Brian McGlinchey is the founder and director of 28pages.org, an information and activism hub for the growing nonpartisan movement to declassify a 28-page finding on foreign government support of the 9/11 hijackers. A native of Philadelphia, who now lives in San Antonio, McGlinchey studied political science at Bucknell University, was a U.S. Army officer, and had a career in financial services before becoming a freelance copywriter. And I woohooed after Philadelphia because that's where I'm from as well.
That's right.
And so, let's go ahead and get into the questions. And I know you were thinking about this one. What was the day of 9/11 like for you?
Like for every other American, it was, a terrible day. At the time, I was working in management at USAA, a large financial services company here in San Antonio, in a call center environment. And speaking of Philadelphia, I had a very good friend working there who grew up in also in the Philadelphia area in Broomall, and he and I would always talk Philadelphia Eagles. That was, Tuesday morning, and I hadn't seen him that week yet, and he came over to my desk with a look on his face, and I just started to smile because I thought we were going to talk about the disappointing home loss to the Rams that had happened a few days ago, and he cut me off before I could say anything, and he said, "Do you know what's happening?" It was kind of an odd question, and I just said no, and he just said, "Come here," and he took me to a break room where there were televisions up, and there was that sight up on the screen of the of both towers in flames. And so that, I always remember that moment. And as you measure the call center environment, and the calls just suddenly evaporated, and it was a tough day for everybody. For a lot of people, one of their priorities was to call their spouse, and my mindset was to do the opposite. My wife at the time was a stay-at-home wife, a spouse, and I wanted her to live in that pre-9/11 world as long as possible. So if she didn't know yet, I didn't want to tell her. I wanted her to have whatever precious extra minutes of blissful ignorance that day that she could have. But so it was a tough day, and then like many people, I think stayed up very late that evening watching the news reports and the coverage of it, and so that was pretty much the day for me.
Well, it's very interesting. My day of 9/11, once I got home from work and they let us go, I watched the news. My eyes were glued to the news set, and they kept showing the towers falling over and over again. And
it
got to me emotionally, and I turned it off and started watching some movies to try and get my mind off of it.
Mm-hmm.
So what was the first thing that you questioned about 9/11?
The first thing that I questioned in any real significant way was this issue of this classified 28 pages.
And how did you come across the knowledge of these 28 redacted pages?
It was through a when I saw a press conference video last summer of Congressman Thomas Massie from Kentucky describing his experience of reading the 28 pages, and he did it in such a provocative, attention-getting way that it just caused me to look into it and start researching more and more about it. And it's kind of so many years had already passed, but I hadn't. And for someone who does keep up with things pretty well, I had not really heard of this 28-page section before, so it really
That's actually surprising to me because of all of the different 9/11 cover-ups, the Saudi cover-up, the 28 redacted pages, is actually the cover-up that gets the most attention. So
Yeah, and
I'm
I
surprised.
had been aware of the Saudi, angle or rumors, all of that type of thing that had been percolating out there. But I think that was the first time I actually knew that there was a 28, there's an actual documentation somewhere that could point, as Bob Graham says, a strong finger specifically, at a country, at Saudi Arabia.
All right. Could you please give us a basic overview of what the 28 redacted pages are and why they should be declassified?
Right. These 28 pages are part of a report of a joint congressional inquiry into 9/11, and specifically into intelligence community activities before and after 9/11. A lot of people, and you even see it in some big media outlets and prominent media platforms, saying that these are in the 9/11 Commission report. But it's actually not. It's not. It's in that report of a joint congressional inquiry that preceded the commission's work, and this report was published in December of 2002. So it is basically a chapter of that report. That report is hundreds and hundreds of pages. I believe in the vicinity of 800 pages. Now, throughout that, there are lots of sporadic redactions of names and places here and there, and maybe a paragraph. And then you come into something that's quite extraordinary, as Congressman Stephen Lynch recently said. This is an extraordinary redaction to suddenly have 28 full pages, an entire chapter, completely redacted. And this chapter deals with specific sources of foreign government support of the 9/11 hijackers while they were in the United States. And as far as why they should be classified, it's really a matter of transparency of an informed public. If you think about 9/11 and all that it has unleashed, all that has been done in the name of 9/11, the money that's been spent, the lives that have been expended, the lives that have been harmed and damaged, policies that we have in the country. The American people deserve to know everything the government knows about 9/11, and particularly as we continue to, go forward and have policies that are supposed to prevent the next 9/11. An informed public in the republic that we have should know everything the government knows about that day.
Absolutely. And, you mentioned the 9/11 Commission, that it was, those 28 redacted pages are not part of the 9/11 Commission. The 9/11 Commission was supposed to start its work from where the Joint Congressional Inquiry left off. We'll get into the 9/11 Commission a little bit later. Could you please tell us a little bit about your background with regards to politics? Is 28pages.org your first foray into activism?
Yeah, I've always been somebody who's had an interest in politics and history, and I studied political science in college. But this is definitely my biggest foray into any kind of activism, learning as I go.
And when did you decide to found 28pages.org?
It was last July. Again, I had watched the Thomas Massie press conference and then delved deeper from there, reading more about the topic. And as I looked on the web researching it myself, I found, hey, there's really no one-stop source of information on this issue or something that was really helping to focus people's interest and energy into actually taking action on it. So when I saw that void there, I decided to go ahead and fill it myself. I am a freelance writer, so I had that, I guess, talent, I will say, to share with the world and to share with this movement to help put out a site that had really good information at 28pages.org on the background of the issue, details, links to supporting documents, and then we have an ongoing blog there that keeps people up to date on developments in the issue and commentary on articles and that type of thing that are out there.
Now,
most importantly, I think, is the resources that we have there to help people take action. A lot of people might see this story and think, oh, man, I wish they would release those 28 pages. Well, we want to help them take that feeling at that moment they're having it and actually do something, which could be as short as 3 minutes or 4 minutes to call Congress and just get your word in that you want them to help declassify it, or maybe a couple minutes longer to print out one of our pre-written letters. But to help people take action, because it's going to I believe it's going to take political pressure to do this. I don't think we can necessarily rely on the just standard operations of government or the consciences of people in government to declassify it. I think they really need that nudge from the people.
Well, do you remember when I first contacted you what my first question was?
Yes, I think you were the first person on Earth to contact me in this role. And,
really? Wow.
I think if something happens on the 9/11 world, I think John Gold is the first one to detect it and be on top of it and know about it.
Well, possibly.
I'd be curious to know.
Go ahead.
I think you had asked if I think you were curious about, as people would naturally be, who's behind this effort, this 28pages.org, and I think you were curious about my motives and what I was going after. I think specifically you were wary of my, I think you said you don't want to start a war with Saudi Arabia, do you? Isn't that right?
Exactly. Well, I just want to, over the years, I've experienced a lot of bullshit with different people, and so I'm a very untrusting soul, unfortunately. You have to earn my trust. So
exactly.
When I the last thing I want to do with regards to exposing Saudi Arabia's role with regards to 9/11 is give an excuse for yet another war. My feelings about 9/11 have always been it wasn't an act of war, it was a crime. And you hold individuals responsible for that crime accountable. You don't hold entire nationalities, ideologies, religions accountable for the actions of a few. And there's actually a term for that. It's called collective punishment. And it's a war crime, and it goes against the Geneva Conventions. So the last thing I want to do is start another war. So that was really what I really concerned about. But
right. If you think about the reaction and what we did in the name of 9/11 after it, and how many multiples of the casualty count of 9/11 have now occurred around the world, I see what you mean by avoiding a...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look at, my God, what we did to Afghanistan and Iraq, especially Iraq. Upwards of 1.25 million people were killed. Millions were displaced. Their infrastructure was destroyed. We were torturing people at Abu Ghraib. We were flushing Korans down the toilet. We used depleted uranium, and now there are sick babies being born. And it's just absolutely horrible. And, part of the problems that we're having today is that there is no statute of limitations on the anger those kinds of things create. So that's part of the tension of what's going on. Part of the individuals that are in Iraq, fighting against the government and so forth. That's part of the problem.
Right.
Another part of
that's definitely. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, another part of the problem has to do with what we in Saudi Arabia have done over the last couple of years with regards to Syria. and I guess I could quickly get into that. First of all, we've been operating covertly in Syria for years. If you want to read about that, you can read Seymour Hersh's articles at the New Yorker.
Right.
But there became a time when we wanted to take out Assad. And so what happened was, under Bandar, Prince Bandar, who happens to be mentioned within those 28 redacted pages, got rebels, quote-unquote rebels, or moderate rebels, or freedom fighters, or terrorists, whatever you want to call them, and sent them into Syria in an effort to take out Assad. And then the U.S. started sending the rebels intelligence, and then they started sending them arms. And then we started sending in rebels from Jordan. By the way, Kuwait and Qatar were all part of this thing. And to take out Assad, this was all an effort to take out Assad. And those rebels that were sent into Syria, started to collaborate with the people who were angry at the U.S. in Iraq. And so that was essentially the formation of ISIS, what's considered to be ISIS.
Right.
But,
and that's one of the points that former Senator Bob Graham, who, as you know, is really leading the charge, beyond Capitol Hill, from his position as a former senator, and who was a co-chair of the intelligence inquiry that produced this, these 28 pages, he's been very forceful in making the point that the suppression of these 28 pages and shielding Saudi Arabia from the consequences of or accountability of its involvement in 9/11, he says, has enabled the rise of ISIS, because the behaviors that they had of funding and spreading extremism went unchecked. And given that, they were encouraged to continue the same behavior and the same type of policies,
well,
helping lead to the disaster that we have unfolding right now.
One of the things I'd like to talk about briefly is, I wrote an article recently, and the title was, "You Can't Point a Finger at Saudi Arabia and Not Have Five Fingers Pointing Back to the U.S. And what I mean by that is, during the Afghanistan-Russia war, we collaborated with Saudi Arabia and the Pakistani ISI to do essentially what we're doing with the rebels in Syria, to support the Mujahideen. And then in the 90s, we collaborated with the Saudis on illegal weapons deliveries to Bosnian Muslims. We used their networks or connections to terrorism to do certain things. And another thing that we did during the 90s is that there were people like FBI agent Robert Wright, who was actually doing an investigation into terrorist financing. And he started to come across people like al-Qaeda, who actually proclaims to have a friendship with Dick Cheney. And his investigation was called Vulgar Betrayal, and it was shut down. They shut it down. And George Tenet will develop these ties.
That code name of that project became a prophecy, didn't it?
Yeah,
Vulgar
well,
Betrayal.
Exactly. And he gave a very sad press conference sometime in 2002, Robert Wright. It's on my YouTube channel if you want to look it up, Gold9472. And he starts crying, and I feel bad for the guy. But anyway, George Tenet developed a relationship with Bandar, and, as a result of that, George Tenet told people that were investigating certain things to, back off the Saudis a little bit. Another thing that we did in June 96, CIA agents were told not to track militants in Saudi Arabia in the wake of the Khobar Towers bombing. And the reason was they didn't want to upset the Saudi government. So we've enabled them. Before 9/11, we collaborated with them, and so on and so forth. And that was before 9/11. And then after 9/11, that protection continued. It got even worse and more aggressive. So anyway, I wanted to talk about that a little bit.
Right. No, I think it's a very good point. It's part of that need for transparency and start to peel that back. The people who've read the 28 pages, you know, they always speak in roundabout ways about what's in there. Another thing that, you know, Thomas Massey said was that, you know, when these are published, there's going to be anger, frustration, and resentment. And, you know, I think a lot of people might at first think he's talking about a foreign country, Saudi Arabia. I think he's talking quite a bit about, as you said, pointing right back at the United States in terms of what we knew, what we neglected, intelligence failures, intelligence, you know, cooperation, or, you know, with other countries that ended up backfiring, you know, all this type of thing. I think that is might be what he's referring to when he talks about that.
Well, there. I think another thing that he's talking about is the fact that, you know, Bandar is named as being, his wife is connected to money of two of the hijackers in San Diego. Bandar is very close with the Bush family. They call him Bandar Bush. And there are many questions about that relationship. And we'll get into that in a minute. But I wanted to ask you, what are some of the revelations you've heard from people about the 28 redacted pages that most interest you?
Well, not knowing exactly what's in there, the Senator Bob Graham, I think, is the one who gets is most pointed. Maybe because he's no longer in Capitol Hill, he seems to be the one who gets the most specific in implying or talking about what's in there. And at the January 7th press conference, which you can, at 20pages.org, people can either, you know, watch the press conference in full or read a transcript or read an article called Must Read Quotes. But he talked very specifically at that press conference. And, you know, whereas other Congress people sometimes back away from mentioning Saudi Arabia, for example, he said the 28 pages point a very strong finger at Saudi Arabia as the principal financier of 9/11. And so I think as far as what's in there that I'm most curious about, it's a lot of people say, well, we've already heard for years that there's Saudi Arabia connections with 9/11. So what's the big deal? And I guess that's the question that's on my mind. I don't think former Senator Graham, Congressman Jones, Lynch, and Massey, I don't think they would be making this effort if whatever in there wasn't provocative enough to merit that. In other words, it must be pretty damning, the next level of detail of what was uncovered as they started to investigate this.
Well, like, now we get
key word.
Now we get to get into a topic, a favorite topic of mine. How familiar are you with the 9/11 Commission, which absolved the Saudi Arabian government?
I'm growing increasingly familiar with it. As I said, this 9/11 was not an interest, something I knew a whole lot about. You know, beyond, you know, what maybe a typical or average plus person might know, you know, from a historical point of view. You know, I had a basic understanding, but since deciding to launch 28pages.org, I've been delving deeper into it, and I'm about to finish reading, thanks to listening to your earlier great episode where you interviewed Philip Shannon, the author of The Commission, I'm wrapping up that book. So I am familiar with it to the extent. You said absolve the Saudi Arabian government. I guess that's a word that's in contention right now. You know, with the big press this week, the New York Times coverage, and the news of the 20th hijacker, Zacharias Moussaoui, testifying as to some specific Saudi connections that he had. Saudi Arabia was quick to point to the 9/11 Commission report this week and declare that it had absolved them, and they've also used that in the court case that is underway, pitting the family members and survivors of 9/11 and the insurance companies that backed them against Saudi Arabia. In that court proceeding, they've tried to point to the commission report as absolving them. But this week, we've seen depositions and affidavits from 9/11 commissioners specifically saying, no, that it's wrong to interpret it as absolving them.
What they did is they pointed to certain charities, but they didn't talk about the government. There's a specific sentence, and unfortunately I did not get it for this interview, that shows, it basically says that the Saudi government had nothing to do with it. And on the release, the day of the release of the 9/11 report, Lee Hamilton specifically said that we have found no evidence that the Saudi government helped to support or had anything to do with 9/11. Now,
Senator Graham had an interesting quote on that topic. At the press conference, a reporter asked, when you say Saudi Arabia, Senator, are you talking about the government or are you talking about private actors? And he said, given the nature of the kingdom, I'm speaking of the kingdom. He says, in fact, in this litigation, whether it's when any institution, whether it's a financial institution, a charitable institution, or a religious institution is raised as a possible co-conspirator, the kingdom throws a blanket of sovereign immunity over every entity. So it is a society in which it's difficult to make the kinds of distinctions between public, private, religious that we would in the United States.
Well, one of the things about the 9/11 Commission that it's famous for is that it said that ultimately it's of little practical significance. The source of the funding for the attacks is of little practical significance. So the 9/11 Commission does in fact absolve the government of Saudi Arabia, and that would include, people like Bandar, who was the ambassador, U.S. ambassador to the United States. And the reason that the 9/11 Commission absolved Saudi Arabia has to do with what I think are two people specifically. And as I said, the 9/11 Commission was supposed to start its work where the Joint Congressional Inquiry left off. Mm-hmm. And what they did is they actually brought people over from the Joint Congressional Inquiry, people like Mike Jacobson and Dana Lieseman, who actually helped to author the 28 redacted pages, to the 9/11 Commission to continue their work. And one of the things Philip Zelikow did, who was the executive director of the 9/11 Commission, was he blocked Dana Lieseman's access to those 28 redacted pages.
Right.
And as a result, she went through a back channel to gain access to those pages, and as a result, Philip Zelikow fired her. Another thing that Philip Zelikow did was he blocked half of the interview requests for Savvy Investigates. And Dieter Snell was, I think he was one of the Saudi investigators. He was a staffer on the 9/11 Commission, on the 9/11 Commission, and he interviewed some of the people that were involved in the, supposedly involved in the Saudi part of the plot. And so what the 9/11 Commission said was that they looked into the allegations of the 28 redacted pages and found, Philip Zelikow referred to them as, quote, wild accusations, but found that they were lacking. And that's interesting to me because, are you familiar with memoranda for the records of the 9/11
yes.
Commission?
Yeah.
Yes, you are? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Just so people know, a memoranda for the record is basically a description of an interview with a witness, a handwritten description of an interview with a witness and there are many available from the 9/11 Commission. And some of the individuals that the 9/11 Commission interviewed that had to do with the supposed Saudi part of the plot, it says directly within those MFRs that these people are not trustworthy at all. And I think there are three of them that say that specifically. And yet Saudi Arabia, you know, was absolved, but quote unquote absolved. But another thing that they did, Philip Zelikow and Dieter Snell took part in a quote late night editing session to remove Saudi government support for the hijackers from the 9/11 report, and they put them, they relegated them into footnotes in the back of the book. So that's essentially why the 9/11 Commission, quote unquote, absolved the government of Saudi Arabia because of those two individuals. But Philip Zelikow is responsible for a hell of a lot more than just that. And he's actually someone that I believe belongs in jail. And that's part of, you know, this whole 28 redacted pages story. I think that is a big story that's being ignored, is his part in absolving.
Right. With this last week, with all the coverage that's been going on of this issue, many outlets turning to and quoting him, which is kind of understandable given his title as executive director. But I think a lot of them, well, pretty much all of them, are negligent in that they're not giving the full story or speaking to the controversial nature of Philip Zelikow and the controversial way in which he executed his role, the conflicts of interest that he had going into that job, where he had personal friends with Condoleezza Rice. That's a conflict of interest, you know, in that he's going to be reviewing her performance leading into 9/11. The fact that he was on the Bush transition team, and on that transition team, he was, I believe, instrumental in the decision to lower the status and access of counterterrorist Richard Clark to the president. So he had
Correct.
A number of things where he was tied in, which points to that. And you know, another thing, during the investigation, frequent phone calls with Bush's political advisor Karl Rove, which, you know, in Philip Shannon's book, The Commission, talks about the staff of the commission being really disturbed by the fact that their boss was having ongoing contacts with the White House when there should have been a completely impartial external entity. So when you had
he told his staffer not to take records of those phone calls.
Right, right. And when you had a White House that was in defense mode of Saudi Arabia, which has been pretty clearly documented, and former Navy Secretary and 9/11 Commission member John Lehman talked specifically about how he felt that the White House was just blatantly cutting off any avenue of inquiry that was pointing towards Saudi Arabia. It was critical that whoever's executive director of that commission take on a adversarial-type role and do that, but every indication is that, you know, and with the conflict of interest, is that that's not at all what Zelikow did. And so that's something that's missing from a lot of the coverage right now when they're quoting Zelikow as an expert on this topic.
I've said that this is being reported on as if it took place within a vacuum, like the 28 redacted pages and the covering up of Saudi Arabia, but they don't get into the context of how Bush and Cheney fought against the joint congressional inquiry from ever taking place. They don't talk about, you know, how they refused to allow Abdusattar Sheikh, who was the landlord of two of the hijackers in San Diego, to testify before the joint congressional inquiry. He was actually an FBI informant. And they tried to make it difficult for his handler, Stephen Butler, to testify before the joint congressional inquiry, but he finally did. You know, there's so much context and so many other things that people need to be aware of. And you talk about Philip Zelikow and his conflicts of interest. He also belonged to the Aspen Strategy Group, who Prince Bandar also belonged to. You know, which is an interesting conflict of interest.
Right.
And
he also helped author the Doctrine of Preemptive War,
which they
for
used
the Bush White House.
For the yeah, for the which they used for the Iraq War.
Right. Exactly.
You know, and you talk about Karl Rove. Karl Rove first elected Henry Kissinger to be the chairman of the 9/11 Commission, and he stepped down after the family members asked him about his business relations with the Bin Laden family.
Right.
So do you, I wonder, gee, would he have been a good person to cover up for Saudi Arabia? Probably. And then Karl Rove selected Thomas Keane and so forth. So he was like, he could be considered an architect of the 9/11 Commission in a way.
Right. I remember Keane was surprised that the call from the White House came from a political advisor and not from maybe a chief of staff or someone in a different, you know, role in the White House, that it was a political, you know, the first indication that this was going to be highly politicized was the fact that the call to Keane came from a political advisor.
Right. And you mentioned John Lehman. And during, when Bush and Cheney went to testify before the 9/11 Commission at the White House, not, you know, together as opposed to being separate, there were no recordings allowed, no transcripts allowed, and they were not under oath. And John Lehman pushed, or, you know, George Bush on the subject with regards to Bandar and Princess Haifa being connected to money of two of the hijackers. And according to Phil Sheehan, Bush, quote, dodged the questions. And, you know, this is a, for that reason alone, George Bush should be, you know, made to stand on the, put on a stand to take questions in a court of law.
Mm-hmm.
Just for that. I mean, it's just so absurd. So anyway,
our system
you know,
of government, you know, that was part of the disappointing execution of the commission was Zelikow's reluctance to put people under oath, to have them you know, sign depositions, to serve subpoenas. It was so soft touch when in our system of government and accountability and checks and balances, you know, nobody should be above swearing to tell the truth about what they've done.
Exactly. And, you know, accountability is one of the biggest issues with regards to 9/11. After the 9/11 attacks, people in government who should have been held accountable for their, you know, what do you, if you want to call it incompetence, if you want to call it criminality, you know, the great thing about accountability is that it applies to both, you know, incompetence and the criminality. People were rewarded and promoted, you know, who should not have been. And one of the things that the family members hoped for with regards to the 9/11 Commission was that they would hold people accountable. And that simply did not happen.
Not
in the least. So, anyway, Philip Zelikow, I think, belongs in jail. And I firmly believe that. But anyway, what will it take to declassify these pages?
Well, the short answer the short route is a simple move of President Obama's signature to just simply declassify it himself. He has that power to do that and has reportedly twice promised 9/11 family members that he would do so.
That's right. Kristen Breitweiser
and Bill Doyle. Who each lost loved ones in the attacks on two different occasions, separated by more than a year, apparently, assured them that he would do that. It's within his power to do that. That's, you know, one route. I think it's going to take political pressure on Obama. I think it's going to take political pressure through Congress to persuade President Obama to do that. There is a little-known alternative route. So the president can declassify it, and there are also rules by which either the Senate or the House can declassify it over the president's objection, starting with a proposal from a member of either the House or the Senate Intelligence Committee. Very long shot route. that is probably not going to come to fruition. So I think the great hope is to have the president do it, and it's going to take political pressure and making it increasingly uncomfortable that these pages are being kept secret in the face of so many credible people saying that there's no good reason for it. You've got the chair and vice chair of the 9/11 Commission. You've got Senator Graham, who co-chaired that intelligence inquiry that produced the 28 pages. You've got congressional representatives from both parties who've read the 28 pages and saying it's not a threat to national security. These need to be released. So hopefully, increasingly, that drumbeat is going to cause these 28 pages to be declassified.
Well, I'm a cynic because, you know, I've been doing this for years, and there was actually an effort in late 2006, the September 11th advocates, or the Jersey Girls, released a petition calling for the declassification of those 28 redacted pages, along with other pertinent 9/11 information. We got 17,000 signatures for their release. We brought it to Washington, D.C., and they were ignored. So, you know, this effort to get them declassified has been going on for years. And I just, you know, we mentioned Obama promising the family members to release those pages. What do you think about what happened with King Abdullah and him going to visit him, and the new king being listed as a defendant in a lawsuit brought on by the 9/11 family members and all that stuff?
Well, the cozier our president is with the king and kingdom of Saudi Arabia, definitely makes you potentially lose hope of getting the 28 pages declassified. I'm sure, and I know personally from communications with some of the 9/11 family members, that seeing that kind of chumminess is really unsettling to those people who lost family members and are in litigation right now with the kingdom.
Well, to me, the whole thing was a big slap in the face to the 9/11 family members. The people that he brought with him were people like John McCain, who loves the 9/11 report, which, again, quote, absolved the Saudi Arabian government. They brought James A. Baker, whose law firm, Baker Botts, represented the Saudis against the 9/11 family members in a very early lawsuit. He brought Condoleezza Rice, who lied before the 9/11 Commission and who had an oil tanker named after her. I mean, it's just a huge slap in the face. Could you please tell us about the mandatory declassification review that is currently underway?
You bet. The mandatory declassification review is a process that is out there for pretty much anybody to request that a classified document be reviewed and considered for release, and it goes through a hierarchy. This process for the 28 pages that's underway right now was initiated by an attorney named Tom Drewlin, who is working with Dan Christensen, Anthony Summers, and Robin Swan. Now, Dan Christensen, as you know, is the investigative journalist at the Florida Bulldog, which used to be Broward Bulldog, who has been digging deep into the 9/11 cell in Sarasota. And then Summers and Swan wrote a book on 9/11. I can't remember the name of that book. Do you remember?
The 11th Day.
That's right, the 11th Day. And they had they've collaborated on this. But so this process has begun, and now it's at the top level of that process. It's in front of the what's called the Interagency Security Classifications Appeal Panel. Now, they review this request, review the 28 pages for whether they should be declassified, and then they make a recommendation to the president. Tom Drewlin in November said that he was told to expect a decision sometime this winter. I talked to Dan Christensen. He's not so sure it's going to be that quick. And there's no timetable on this and a lot of things where the government can kind of run the clock out and go to four corners and just let time tick by. I'm not really optimistic about this because if you take a look at the panel that comprises this board, at the representative, you know, senior level representatives appointed by the Department of State, the Department of Defense, the Department of Justice, the National Archives, the Officer of the Director of National Intelligence, the National Security Advisor, and the Director of the CIA can opt to appoint a voting member. So this is not a panel of American peers. This, you know, if you look at that list, I'm sure you're thinking the same thing I am. It's kind of the usual suspects of who want to keep this classified and who may personally, professionally benefit by keeping it classified. So it's not real sure that, you know, other than maybe the National Archives, or the rest of that list, you look at it and you're not really optimistic that those representatives representing their respective department is going to, you know, do the right thing and recommend. And even if they do recommend, we're right back to it being a recommendation to the president. Now, if it did happen, it would be very extraordinary and I think would amp up the pressure on Obama to declassify it. But I think I'm not really optimistic about that route, which is why we're really encouraging people who want to see these pages released to get involved. And it doesn't take much time at all to get involved. You know, the principal avenue of this movement right now is House Resolution 14. It was introduced by Congressman Walter Jones of North Carolina and Stephen Lynch of Massachusetts, a Republican and a Democrat. These have very bipartisan support. Both sides of the aisle are represented on this resolution. It's a resolution that urges the president to declassify the 28 pages. So it itself is not binding either, but again, builds that political pressure that we're talking about. And so our emphasis at 28pages.org is on having people contact their House representative and get them to read the 28 pages and support the resolution, co-sponsor resolution H-Res 14, to declassify it and to contact the Senate and help us get a senator to introduce a resolution in that body along the same lines urging the president to do this. It's important, it's interesting to note that several years ago there were 46 senators co-signed a letter to then-President Bush urging him to declassify the 28 pages, 46. So we've been there before, and we're hoping to get back there again to where you've got that many people. And once you get to 51, now that alternative process I talked about where the Senate could declassify it by itself or the House could declassify it by itself but is, you know, becomes viable. But so that's why we try to focus people on contacting Congress.
Are you hoping that releasing the 28 redacted pages of the Joint Congressional Inquiry will lead to opening up doors to other cover-ups concerning 9/11?
In terms of the word cover-up, to me, one of the ones that I'm most interested in is, you know, we mentioned a moment ago, is, for example, the Sarasota cell. Here is a situation where we had 9/11 hijackers who were having frequent contact and physical visits with a wealthy, well-connected Saudi family in Sarasota. That family up and urgently left the country about 2 weeks before 9/11. And we talk about urgency, we mean to the extent that there were brand new, newly registered vehicles in the driveway, fresh food in the refrigerator and on the counter, clothing still on the rack in the closets, you know, safe door swinging open in the bedroom. I mean, that's how sudden we're talking about. And this cell was not even disclosed to the FBI knew about it and didn't disclose it to Senator Graham and to the inquiry that produced the 28 pages. You know, by all indications, the 28 pages, I think, you know, are hinging a lot on the San Diego cell and what we knew about then. Well, the FBI has been blocking attempts to get access to and understand what they know about this cell in Sarasota, and that's what the Florida Bulldog has been so doggedly pursuing is FBI documents on that. At first, the FBI said that they checked into it and that they found no connection, that there's basically nothing to it. And then Dan Christensen asked them for documents about that, you know, how they reached that conclusion, they said, well, we don't really have any documents, which just, you know, any investigation of even a missing dog is going to have a document, much less this. Well, now there's a Freedom of Information lawsuit underway, and there's a federal judge who's taking a very skeptical look at the FBI and its conduct, and he's now reviewing what they have coughed up 80,000 pages of documents relating to that cell. So to me, that, you know, the 20 pages is going to be interesting and open a door, but I think it's going to cause people to now start looking elsewhere, looking to Sarasota, and, you know, there are many other locations that Senator Graham says, you know, we don't know what was missing there. Were there were other cells in, I think, Falls Church, Virginia, Paterson, New Jersey, you know, other locations. Well, are there other Saudi connections there as well, potentially? So, and it's not just about knowing what the Saudi connections might be. It's also about peeling back and revealing what is the nature of this cover-up by the FBI. Why are they so gun-shy about sharing what they've
done? Well, the FBI is, you know, they have their investigation, the Penbomb investigation, and they would have meetings, or they had a meeting with the family members, and, you know, we were told that there was no warning that the 9/11 attacks were going to come, that nobody had any idea that this was going to happen, and one of the questions Kristen Brottweiser asked was, how is it possible that within hours of the attacks, you guys could swoop in on the exact flight schools that these people, you know, were training at if you had no idea that this was going to happen? And they were told that they got lucky, you know. So the FBI, you know, look at their anthrax attack investigation, how horrible that was. They're not exactly the most trustworthy organization in the world. And they have a lot to answer for with regards to 9/11, about other issues. You know, again, like I said, Robert Wright was shut down. Why was he shut down? So the thing about the 28 redacted pages that's important to the families is that they want to bring it in to the courtroom as evidence, you know, to use. And every time that 9/11 makes it into a courtroom, we learn a lot of information that we didn't know before, you know,
exactly,
that was supplied to us from the 9/11 Commission, and, you know, the quote unquote definitive account of 9/11. And, you know, it's interesting, Moussaoui this week, you know, it's being reported about his statement that he gave to lawyers representing the family members about what he knew about Saudi Arabia, people in Saudi Arabia helping to finance the attacks. And I quickly want to say, before we talk about Moussaoui, is that he was never actually, it was never ruled that he was insane. He was ruled competent.
Right.
To stand trial, so
where his defense attorneys made the argument, you know, in the act of defending him, but that argument
right.
is not found compelling, and he was deemed competent.
Exactly. So people will say that, well, he's a crazy nut, and that we shouldn't listen to what he says, but that's not exactly the case. So this week he brought up names like Prince Bandar, Turki Alfazl, the owner or one of the owners of Fox News, who just dumped all of his Fox News stock, I think, or some of it. And, you know, what happened at the Moussaoui sentencing phase, it wasn't actually a trial, it was a sentencing phase, because he had pled guilty. We found out from the FBI agent Michael Antisef that, of course, the FBI was well aware that Al-Qaeda had plans to slam, or they thought of the idea of terrorists slamming planes into buildings or using them as weapons and so forth. And, you know, we were told repeatedly that no one had any idea and nobody in government could possibly conceive of this. And here we have an FBI agent telling us the exact opposite. So, you know, a lot can come out in a court of law. And, I would love to see Philip Zelikow be called in to testify, to explain why the 9/11 Commission's report, absolved him, essentially. But anyway,
Right.
what have
I guess
been,
I was just going
go
to say
ahead.
the other interesting angle that potentially could come out of this 28 pages is more perspective, perhaps, on FBI agent Mark Rossini being told he was assigned to the 9/11 CIA unit and was forbidden to share information about the San Diego hijackers with FBI higher ups, which looks like
Right.
probably the most deadly decision in this whole thing. It might be some more perspective on that to the extent this might focus on San Diego.
Well, now you just opened up a whole can of worms. The Alex Station incident that he's referring to, and Alex Station was the name of the CIA's Bin Laden unit. Mark Rossini found out that one of the hijackers got a visa to enter the United States, and he was assigned, along with Doug Miller, to Alex Station, and he wanted to send a cable. It was Doug Miller, I think, that wanted to send the cable, wasn't it, or was it Mark
I
Rossini?
think so. I believe it was
Well, either
they were
way,
both told not to. Yeah, they were working together.
one of them wanted to send the cable, and they were told by Michael Ann Casey not to send the memo to the FBI, and she was directed to tell them that by Tom Wilshire. But later in the day, Michael Ann Casey sends out a cable within the CIA, telling them that the FBI had been notified, which seems like extremely criminal behavior to me. But you're right. When you look at the San Diego hijackers, that leads to other stories. Like, for instance, the NSA said that they were monitoring about 8 phone calls that the hijackers made from San Diego to the Yemen hub, the Al Qaeda hub in Yemen. But they couldn't, decipher where the calls were coming from. They can only tell where the calls were going to. And we found out from NSA whistleblower William Binney, and confirmed by Thomas Drake on my show, that the NSA did know the identities of the phone calls of the hijackers, where the calls were coming from, which meant that the NSA knew those terrorists were in the United States and didn't bother to tell the FBI. So that's something else that who knows what could come out of this.
Right. And I think it points back to Thomas Massie saying if this comes out, there's going to be anger, frustration, and resentment. And I think a lot of that could point at our own intelligence agencies and their conduct.
Well, apparently, Thomas Drake from the NSA, I think, testified before the Joint Congressional Inquiry, and there's no record of his testimony, just the fact that he testified. They like destroyed it, according to him.
Right.
Have I already asked you what have been some of the biggest obstacles you've become aware of since starting this fight to release these pages? No,
No, but
I haven't.
I think some of the obstacles are, in the House trying to get HRS 14 moving along. It's been a two-step process at this point of first trying to get people in Congress to read the 28 pages, which they have to ask permission of their intelligence committee to do so, and then go into a quiet, soundproof room where they are have two minders watching them. They're not allowed to bring a notebook in there and read these
Horrible.
28 pages. And yes, you've got that hurdle. And every indication is that very few in Congress have bothered reading the 28 pages. Which, if you think about it, you've got Congressman Thomas Massie, when he read the 28 pages and got my attention at the press conference, when he described the experience of reading it, he said, he talked about going to that soundproof room, and he said it was a very disturbing event for me to read this. He said, I had to stop every two or three pages and rearrange my perception of history. And it's that fundamental, he said. Now, you and I are curious to read what's in the 28 pages. We're citizens, right? We've got all these House representatives and senators who are charged with helping to guide the foreign and defense and counterterror policy of this country. Who have not bothered reading the 28 pages? It's a half an hour, you know, to read 28 pages. You'd think out of simple human curiosity they'd want to read the 28 pages, much less their professional duty to read the 28 pages. So, you know, that's kind of an obstacle, is pushing against that. Congressman Stephen Lynch, the one of the leaders on this issue, he recently set up that January 7 press conference, and he's going to try a different tack in this session of Congress, which is to basically ask his peers to trust him and his judgment that, you know what, these can be declassified. You don't necessarily need to read it yourself. You should, so you can, you know, have a deeper understanding of the terror apparatus that we're dealing with. But he's going to try to get people to start co-sponsoring the resolution, even if they haven't read it. That's the challenge. And the other challenge is the fact that there are no, and we touched on this in a recent blog post at 28pages.org, is that, you know, one of the things that distinguishes this fight is that, you know, you've got vocal people on one side arguing, but then there's really no vocal champion out there arguing on the other side. You know, the forces that are keeping this quiet are behind the scenes. They're hidden. They're, you know, a big web of influence that Saudi Arabia has on Capitol Hill with lobbyists, including former Senator Norm Coleman, who co-chairs a major Republican super PAC and who once condemned Saudi Arabia for spreading extremism. He's now a lobbyist for Saudi Arabia. And it goes on and on. The money that Saudi Arabia donates to think tanks that, you know, are quoted in the media, and we don't realize, you know, the influence that Saudi Arabia and other countries have through these think tanks.
Well, I said today that, you know, the cover-up or protecting Saudi Arabia is not just about oil or the fact that they could influence gas prices and so forth. It's about the fact that people in this country love Saudi Arabian money and also their influence in the region. But people love, you know, their money, like the Bush family.
Right.
You know,
you've got that foreign influence, and you're also another quiet force that is on the other side of this is the intelligence community, as we just talked about. I think has a very strong interest in keeping this quiet and shielding themselves from embarrassment and accountability. And so, you know, they're very influential. They're very influential on the intelligence committees that deal with this topic. You know, the people who end up on the intelligence committees in the House and the Senate, they're almost invariably people who play ball for the Intelligence Committee and who, rather than being overseers, end up being spokespeople and defenders of the Intelligence Committee instead of, you know, adding that layer of accountability that they're supposed to by our system of government.
Yeah, it's really disgusting. I know. What do you have to say to people who think releasing the 28 redacted pages is a, quote, limited hangout?
And by that, you know, for our audience, I think limited hangout's a term that was inadvertently coined by President Nixon. I believe he was on the tapes talking about a limited hangout, meaning you have some secret you're keeping, and you, correct me if I'm wrong here, John, but you put out just enough to maybe satisfy people's appetite, but in fact, you're holding back on the greater secret. Is that right?
Well, some people have said that, you know, they're just letting this part of the cover up out to satisfy people's curiosity,
yeah,
and so on and so forth. And I just think, you know, I talked to Lori Van Auken, one of the Jersey Girls, about this, and she says, release the pages, you know. This is just one aspect of the cover-up, but it has to be resolved. So release the pages, and maybe, like as we talked about, it will lead to other things. Right now there are people out there, the people who say Israel did 9/11, they're piggybacking their little theory that Israel did 9/11 on this push to get these 28 redacted pages released, because, you know, it talks about multiple foreign entities. And I have never, ever once heard anybody related to the Joint Congressional Inquiry, never once from Bob Graham, have I ever heard any indication that these pages talk about Israel. In fact, if you read the Joint Congressional Inquiry into 9/11, they praise Israeli intelligence. And I don't think that they would praise Israeli intelligence only to come back and say, you know, Israel was supported the hijackers
right,
in any way.
Right. And so, for those people who think, you know, based on you know, various documented things like the Israeli art students and the dancing Israelis, that type of thing, you know, which people can look up. It's one thing for them to think, oh, maybe Israel had foreknowledge or whatever. It's another to conclude, oh, that's in these 28 pages. There, like you said, there's been no indication from anybody who's read the 28 pages and who talks about it. I mean, I don't know what's in the 28 pages. I don't know.
Right, but there's an absolute...
What you and I both work off of is, okay, what do we specifically hear from people who have read the 28 pages? And so there's
exactly.
Somebody out there who has read them who hints in this direction. And yes, it does say multiple countries, but you know, that could very well be other Gulf states. So
I was going to ask you, what countries are your guesses? My guesses are the UAE, possibly Turkey, maybe Qatar. I don't know. Those are my guesses. What do you think?
I really don't know either. I just don't know. I'm thinking, you know, Gulf states is what I would lean towards, but let's get those 28 pages out and we can end all this speculation.
Right, exactly.
On the 28 pages, there's going to be more speculation after that, but let's get it out there and decide what it means.
Yeah, exactly. Just, you know, let's resolve this one issue. Maybe it'll lead to other things, hopefully.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, Ray McGovern, who, you know, was a CIA analyst, he talked about the 28 pages in December, and he thinks they're pretty significant. He says, you know, there's so many things about the story of 9/11. He said that need to be put together. He says, and he said, I think these 28 pages are going to start unraveling just like a mummy. He said, you know, pull on these 28 pages, and then you're going to unravel the whole thing. So,
we'll see. You know, my thing is, arrest Philip Zelikow, I'll put him on the stand. I think if you tug on that thread, it would, you know, the whole 9/11 cover-up would unravel. But,
right.
You know, the 28 redacted pages are important. What can people do to help get these pages released? Just call their senators, write their representatives.
Go to 28pages.org, and on there you'll see a link on the top that says Take Action. And you know, depending on how much time you have, a quick call to Congress. We've got a little script there. I mean, really, to call Congress and register your opinion by calling, you don't need to be prepared to give a big speech. You just need to tell them to support House Resolution 14 and ask them if they've read the 28 pages. We're trying to put pressure on Congress to read the 28 pages, not only so that they feel more confident and interested in declassifying them, but also so they're, you know, we've taken that first step of at least Congress being informed and understanding the dynamics of this so that they can cast informed vote. So going to 28pages.org, calling Congress. We've got, if you don't feel like making the phone call, we've got pre-written letters where you can just print it out, fill in your info, and mail it off to Congress. And again, these letters and our phone calls, we always emphasize asking, have they read the 28 pages? Have they asked permission to do so and to support the resolution? So you know, that's the main thing that they can do. And it doesn't take much time, and it does have an impact. You know, people get skeptical about our ability to sway policy, but it really does matter. Politicians do care. They care about votes. They care about opinions, sometimes too much. But you know, here's a case where we can use their concentration on votes and elections and embarrassment and turn it to something good and turn it into transparency on this issue.
Well, I would argue, my feelings are that Congress is bought and paid for, but, you know, whatever.
But that's true, but if there are
I'm
examples...
I'm the cynic.
If you look at the alleged chemical weapon attack in Syria that was going to be used to launch a drive-by cruise missile strike, you know, what the thing that turned that back was people calling Congress. There's no doubt. At the time, it was said, you know, 90% of the calls that were coming in said, don't get involved in this, do not do this, do not intervene, and that turned it back. So, I mean, I definitely share and understand the general feeling of frustration. And
well, I think Russia had a lot to do with that as well, Russian pressure.
Well, yeah. But I think the American public really played a big role in that, too.
Is there anything else that you would like to promote at this time?
No, just, you know, people going to 28pages.org, and also, you know, we've got a presence on social media. If you're on Twitter, please follow us our tag is at 28pages. We're on Facebook, facebook.com/28pages911. You can just go to 28pages.org, and you'll find links those as well. Joining, you know, following us in social media helps in a couple ways. Number one, you, the listeners, will stay informed of what's going on with this issue, which I think is a very interesting issue. And number two, it's numbers. You know, politicians, the media, they look at numbers, and you know, the more followers that we have on Facebook and social media, you know, it starts to get their attention that there's a lot of people who care about this and are interested in it, and it also is a way for interested listeners to share and pass this information on and build this awareness of this issue.
Right. Well, I want to thank you very much, Brian, for what you're doing, and I want to thank you for promoting my show the other day. That was very kind of you.
Oh, yeah, it was very sincere. I mean, it's been an impressive, I'm kind of honored to join what's been a very impressive list of guests that you've been putting together. I really enjoy the show.
I'm doing my absolute best to put forward the best of the best. So, you know, and the fact that we were lied to about 9/11, that's the truth. We were lied to about 9/11, and that's something I'm hoping a lot of people come to accept. Anyway, I want to thank you very much for your time today, and good luck with everything. And if you
Great.
Need
thank
help,
you so
let
much.
Me know.
I will. Thank you.
All right. Take care.